You're listening to the Social Media Show, sponsored by NILC, a training company providing over 500 business, IT and project management training courses. I'm your host, Jonathan Pollinger, and I'm a social media trainer. In each week's episode of this podcast, I chat with an inspiring personality from the world of business or social media. As well as listening to the podcast, you can watch the show live on Mondays at 9 a.m. on my Facebook page at facebook.com/PollingerSocial, where you can also catch the replay.
Hello and welcome to the first The Social Media Show of 2020. It's episode 25, featuring Penny Andrews, writer and commentator. We talk about internet culture, politics, fandom, oh, and boomer memes. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the first The Social Media Show of 2020. And great to have Penny Andrews with me this morning. Good morning, Penny.
Morning, Jonathan.
Fantastic to have you on the show. So lots to talk about, and it looks to me like you've got quite a busy year ahead. I think you probably ran out of words in your Twitter bio to document all the different things that that you do. So to kick off, perhaps you could sort of run through one or two of those, and we can take it from there.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a big fan of procrastinating working. So I get work done by doing other work. I'm not very good at relaxing. So this year I'm trying to finish my PhD thesis, hopefully in the first half of this year at University of Sheffield.
What's your PhD on?
It's really boring. Well, it's not boring, but it's something I lost. It's something I ended up losing interest in quite a while ago. It's just the way with PhDs, I think. It's about open access policy in higher education and the systems people use to manage that and how people sort of feel about it. So the gap between what the policy is meant to do and then how universities implement it and how people feel about it. So actually the stuff that people say is really interesting, but when I tell people the topic, unless they're in academia, they just go, which is fine. I've effectively done a second PhD while I've been doing the PhD about politics fandom.
Wow.
So people being fans of politicians and parties and campaigns. And out of that, yeah, I've sort of started writing academic stuff, but also freelance journalism, which has taken up a lot of my time, as well as creative stuff. So pretty busy.
Yeah, we'll talk about the political fandom later on, because I've seen, you know, you do tweet quite a lot about that, and a few articles as well. So that's quite fascinating. But there's other things as well. Well, you do it on there, so keep on going.
So yeah, I do drag. I drag up as Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher, as two characters, Tonti Belair and Cracked Thatcher, which is kind of a cross between David Bowie and Margaret Thatcher. I do stuff around social media, oddly enough, when I do write about that and about data. As part of during my PhD, I teach data science students about the social side of data and sort of helping them to be more ethical data scientists, so teaching about power and bias and surveillance and things like that. I also end up teaching academics about social media because they share a lot of fake news. So I've ended up doing a lot of stuff with previous guests on the show, Jennifer Jones, about misinformation and how people who really should know better and kind of perhaps are dismissive about other groups of people kind of going, oh, well, of course, boomers share fake news, or of course, young people share fake news. Of course, these other people share fake news, but obviously they will share it if it suits their preferences. I've also sort of written a play, or half a play.
Right. Okay, wow.
So, yeah, I do quite a lot, and then I'm also interested in more media stuff beyond the writing. So I made a Radio 4 programme last year, and I hope to make more documentary type stuff this year.
Fantastic. It does sound as though all those sort of things can be kind of like interlocked into each other. Is that sort of how it works, or do you find yourself sort of concentrating on one thing and then get that done and move on to the next one?
I've tried to make them feed into each other. The thing that suffered on that is me actually finishing my PhD thesis. But to be fair, while I did my PhD, I also had major surgery. I had both my jaws broken deliberately. Right. But, you know, it took quite a long time in recovery and got hit by a car and broke my ankle.
Sorry, that sort of explains.
Yeah. So that and losing interest in it means that, because it's not as related or as fun as the other things, has fallen by the wayside. I need to push that a bit more. But generally speaking, the other things interlock quite well, I think. And I think it makes what I do more interesting because I have such a wide range of people on my social media and in my life that I don't have a kind of locked in view of things. It's not coming just from academia or from journalism or from creative world or from like social media people or from policy people or politics people. It's all kind of interlocking. So I have a wider view of things, I think.
So almost that one project can almost like feed into another. Is that sometimes how it works? You can sort of get a different perspective or pick up ideas help you in other areas?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem I generally have is having too many ideas and not enough time to do them all. But they do tend to feed each other. And I think it's healthier when they do that and when I can make it work like that. So the research I do for one thing might feed into another thing, or this piece of writing might spark off this other thing in another area of my life, or I can kill two birds with one stone when I go to a physical place. I might be going there for a campaigning reason, for example, but I'll do some journalism stuff or I'll do some teaching stuff or whatever while I'm there.
Yeah, so it does also sound like you've got a pretty sort of good mix of digital and physical world. I don't like to call it sort of like real world, because I think the digital is the real world, isn't it? But so... Is that fair to say? Is it a sort of balance? You're not sort of like locked in an office all day. You are sort of out doing events and meeting people as well, and consultancy.
Yeah, I really love meeting people, and I spend an awful lot of time on trains because I'm based in Leeds. I work in Sheffield for my PhD and my teaching. I go to London a lot because that's where a lot of media and politics stuff is. And when I do campaigning stuff relating to disability or whatever, that's where I go. I really like traveling. I kind of miss the fact that sort of a couple of years ago I was traveling a lot because I was very good at applying for bursaries to go to conferences and things and then making the most out of my time there. So I'm hoping once I've got the thesis out of the way, I can try and get some money together and travel again. But what I really love is meeting up with people that I've met on digital, I suppose, or following up real life.
Yeah.
Meet space connections online. So there's people I met in Australia, you know, 3 years ago, and I'm still in touch with them because of Twitter, and
Fantastic. We're
back and forth all the time. Whereas if I just met them for a couple of days and there wasn't that side of things, then it would just have drifted, you know, wouldn't have been able to maintain that.
Yeah, I think social media can be quite a good glue, really, can't it, in those sort of circumstances to help sort of bind relationships together, as you say, that would otherwise perhaps not happen. And it's interesting you say there about using it to both sort of follow up meetings that you've had as well as meet people and then sort of go on to meet them in real life. I think that's a good sort of dynamic of social, isn't it?
Yeah, it's being able to get a bit of both, because I'm autistic, so I often find initiating conversations with people I don't know, it's all quite difficult. But because of social, you can kind of do all of that awkward small talk, what do we have in common, who are you, where are you from, all of that stuff can be done before you go somewhere. So if I walk into a conference or a meeting or, you know, any kind of event or even a gig, I can see people that I've met on social, and all of that awkwardness is cut out of the way and we can just have a chat. But equally, like, people will, you know, barely speak to in the room at an event, but it was like, but you did an interesting thing, but you were in the other room and I barely got to talk to you. that fleeting thing doesn't just disappear, you know. It's like, you're interesting, or I saw the tweets about your talk that was going on, I want to get to know you. I really like that symbiotic thing. I don't like it to be just one side or the other. I've met quite a lot of my Twitter, which is really nice, and I quite like to meet more.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant for events, and I'm always talking about that sort of in a business context, because as you say, you can kind of like research people before they're going, and particularly if the event's got a hashtag associated with it, you've got a whole story going on there, haven't you? Because you've got the sort of beginning of the story where people are sort of perhaps traveling down to the event, you've got the middle, which is the event itself, and then what I think is quite often the most interesting bit is the follow-up, because as you say, if you haven't quite managed to see somebody, or you have seen somebody and you want to follow up that conversation, or perhaps do some work with them or something, then you can use social to do that, to keep the contact and keep the event going almost as well in some respects. So so as well as using social media sort of in your day-to-day life and day-to-day work, I mean, you also write about it, don't you? I read your Times article just before Christmas about Facebook and the election. That was quite interesting. Do you think social media, kind of like a bit of an open goal, this question, but do you think social media had let's put it another way, what sort of impact do you think social media had on the UK election this time around?
Well, I think in some cases it was overplayed, in the sense that Jeremy Corbyn won the Twitter war and he won the organic shares of video and things like that, of stuff that had actually been made by him or people close to his team. But the message that really cut through in the election in terms of winning was get Brexit done. And I think that was really hammered by social media as well. It just made things clearer for people. And also, when there is so much noise through social and through traditional media and through conversations at the bus stop and all the rest of that, those very simple messages and graphics and the boomer memes by the Conservative Party do actually really work. So there was that. And also,
do you want to just explain that for those people that might not know what boomer meme is?
Oh, right. So boomer memes are not necessarily boomers, not necessarily creating the memes, although they're in the style of ones created by older people who are perhaps less au fait with digital tools, not just social media, but being able to do design. But they're sort of deliberately rubbish looking memes with perhaps bad fonts, garish graphics that create conversations around them. The team led by Isaac Levido, working on the Conservative campaign, have been doing this in Australia, that they've created these memes that connect with those older voters, but also get younger people to share them derisively. You know, they're kind of been sharing them to kind of go, this is rubbish, and mock them. But actually that furthers...
That helps the algorithm, doesn't it? Yeah.
It helps the algorithm. And also it just hammers things into your brain, because I remember when I was in music many years ago and I was talking to somebody in music journalism, and he said he would never write about a band or even be interested in kind of listening to a new band if he hadn't heard about them from 3 to 5 different sources who weren't the band or people directly connected with them.
Yeah.
Sort of just separately and organically, because he'd be like, well, then they're a thing. So it would kind of have to be there in the ether as a name he would keep hearing before he would write about them. And I think there's a certain amount of that with politics as well, that you get this kind of background awareness of something, and then it hits into your head. So people go, why do Coca-Cola need to advertise? It's because you always want that holidays are coming, Coca-Cola truck it, or the real thing, or whatever. You have those slogans in your head, even if you are, you know, mocking of them, or you think that the advertising doesn't affect you. And then when you're going to buy a drink, you're probably not buying own brand, right?
Yeah, you're going to ask for a Coke rather than a Pepsi, aren't you? So
you're going to ask for a Coke rather than a Pepsi, and that's kind of what's happening with political messaging as well. It doesn't matter if you think it's rubbish the first time or you don't like the person who's saying it, if it's a good enough message. Get Brexit done connected with people who weren't Brexiteers, because the getting it done bit was the bit that they liked. They just want it out of the way. And so it was a useful multi-purpose slogan, whereas everything everybody else was doing was either really long or only appealing to one group.
Yeah. And do you think this kind of like a boomer meme thing will continue, or do you think the public might sort of wise up to it and realize what's going on? Or do you think it's just like natural instinct that we're going to respond to that kind of, it's also called shit posting, isn't it? Those kind of posts. What do you think? Do you think it'll?
I think we'll see an evolution of it. I think we'll see an evolution of it. So in the 2017 election, a lot of the stuff that connected was from the Tory side was very negative ad hominem posts that were quite sophisticated and videos about different politicians. But the Labour side did better with a lot of memes, positive videos, stuff about policy. A couple of years down the line, people were tired of that. They didn't want to watch a whole video. They weren't that bothered. Only people who already agreed with it were interested in that. People found the whole forwarding WhatsApp messages quite creepy. People had tried using their Tinder profiles a couple of years ago to get people to vote.
Really?
And that worked. You know, people lent their Tinder profiles to a campaign, and it basically used a bot to say, you know, are you to swipe somebody, make a connection, and say, are you voting? But 2 years on, obviously people were wise to that. So I think in the next election, you'll see more of these emotional appeals that are perhaps, you know, very different to political advertising in the past, but it won't be the same techniques because people have changed. And also the electorate have changed. So in 2016, 2017, the people who were very engaged online were people who were already very engaged in politics and were very engaged online. A few years later, because so many people have got involved in campaigning on both sides of the Brexit debate, and to do with local campaigns, to do with buses or their hospital, and environmental stuff to do with Extinction Rebellion and the climate strike and things like that. People of all ages who perhaps had a Facebook or a Twitter profile or an Instagram profile but weren't super users, you know, they were just talking to their immediate friends and family on it, have become much more politically active on there. So when I wrote an article for The Independent about memes that were being shared around Yvette Cooper, because everyone has seen the vast volume of stuff that's aimed at Diana, but that's not unusual. That's happened ever since she got into politics. There was stuff being sent to her personally, and then obviously that just moved online. And whenever I scratch any political group, there's horrible stuff about Diana. But when it came to Yvette Cooper, it was just really, really horribly personal stuff, and just the volume of it. And most of it was being created not by young, savvy people. When you went, because on Facebook you could click through to see who'd created stuff, who'd shared stuff, where an image perhaps had originated, it was mostly by people who were quite financially secure, either retired or small business owners, or just sole traders, self-employed, who had nothing to lose in terms of employability by sharing social media, because they knew either their customer base wouldn't see it or they wouldn't care. And they were creating very, very partisan stuff, but also very, very unpleasant stuff in vast volumes, writing traitor across people's heads, writing all of these messages about betrayal and we're going to get you out and how they should all hang and things like that. And that was very interesting to me, because when people talk about memes and social media, they generally think about these young, digitally savvy, momentum bros kind of things. But actually, most of the stuff that we've seen in the Brexit debate and a lot of the climate stuff is actually older people with time on their hands, and perhaps not massive amounts of design skills. A lot of this stuff looks like it's created in paint.
Which it probably was then.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's vastly compressed. It's full of digital artifacts. It's everything that you wouldn't do in design, you know, 27 million fonts. Bad clip art, stolen images, sometimes even, you know, with artifacts still on them from where they originate from. And it doesn't matter, because the people they're talking to aren't looking for something that slick. And I think we'll see more and more of that DIY almost punk approach.
That's interesting. Do you think, what about fake news? Do you think that's going to continue to be a problem? And a big question, but what can we do about it?
I think it is going to keep increasing, not least because people on all sides of every debate seem to have it in for the BBC, sometimes justifiably in terms of some of the editorial decisions being made, but you know, it's got into the realms of conspiracy theory, which is never good. And attacking the mainstream media generally and trusting politicians is never particularly high, but it's very low worldwide at the moment.
Yeah, probably
low. So I think we'll see more and more. I think what we'll see more and more stuff that is not necessarily completely fake, because I think people are starting to get more wise to ways to check whether something's completely fake. But we'll see stuff that has some basis in truth but has lost all its context. And that's much harder for us to combat, because it's easy to kind of go, no, that definitely didn't happen, about something that didn't happen. Look, I can show you a source that says that didn't happen. But if something has got some basis in truth and it's just been extrapolated or misinterpreted, that's much harder to unpick with people. And I don't really know how we're going to tackle that at the moment.
It's the grey stuff, isn't it, that's difficult to establish one way or the other. I think even the even the official fact checkers have trouble when it comes to that, because they can't sort of, it's not a black and white thing, they can't sort of say true or false. There's more.
That's
to it.
They say
that.
Partially true. You know, like there was a
misleading
story. There was a story yesterday about Rebecca Long Bailey, who's one of the Labour leadership contenders, and today's National Executive Committee NEC meeting for Labour that will decide the rules for the Labour leadership contest. And there was a Huffington Post story that went up. I think it was the Huffington Post, maybe. No, Politics Home. Politics Home story that went up that said, Rebecca Long Bailey can go to this meeting about the NEC, and they'd obviously got some quotes from people saying, oh no, she shouldn't, because she shouldn't be deciding the rules if she's in the contest, which is fair enough. But while it was true that she could be in the meeting because she is one of the shadow cabinet reps, she was never going to go to the meeting. And a version later in the day, when they'd actually managed to get hold of her or her team, said she's recused herself, she's not going to go to this meeting for obvious reasons. But that didn't stop lots of people who are, you know, have blue ticks on their profile, are political journalists and editors or high level political commentators that have a lot of followers, that have a lot of authority and weight and authenticity given to their opinions. Like when they say something has a lot of reach, but also it carries a lot of authority, saying, oh, this is terrible. They're obviously trying to, you know, bend the contest to how they want. And no, it's just literally she could go, just same as Jeremy Corbyn could go. It doesn't mean that he's going to influence it to whatever he wants. It's just there's a list of people who are allowed to attend those meetings. And unless they recuse themselves, then they can go. But it doesn't mean that they will. It's ridiculous. It's like any meeting. Obviously, you would remove yourself from discussions about your own salary. if you were on the paying, the pay group at your own work. But obviously it suited people to kind of go, oh no, Jeremy Corbyn is good. And all his followers, they're trying to make it so that his successor is and it's just, that's the kind of stuff I think is really, really hard to tackle, because I don't think people, when they're kind of being outraged to their followers, realize how much reach they have and how important it is for them to then correct stuff or delete stuff if they've got it wrong.
That's a good point. I think it's considerably down to speed, isn't it? Because, you know, we live in such a fast sort of fast moving time now, and there's that pressure that if you come across a bit of news or you've got an opinion, you just sort of get it out there straight away. And that's sort of so far removed from traditional journalism, where things were fact checked, edited, proofed, and all the rest of it. So that gives rise to this sort of added danger of fake stuff being reported, doesn't it? Even by legitimate journalists, as we saw during the election. And I agree. I think there should be more. It's difficult, you know, the horse has bolted to a certain degree, but there should be more corrections put out. And again, during the election, there were quite a few examples where it was proven that things weren't correct, but the tweets still remained there, which is not good. So I think that's something that could be improved on. Might help.
I mean, it'd be quite nice if it was possible for the platforms to be able to get rid of screenshots and things like that as well, because sometimes somebody will have deleted something that's incorrect, and they know it's incorrect, and they've perhaps apologized for it on their own profile, but it will still be circulating weeks and even months later as a kind of gotcha, as a screenshot. Yeah. And there's no way to kind of overlay that with they deleted this for saying it was wrong. You have no control over that footprint. If you said it once, it's there.
Yeah, that's a very difficult one, because on the other hand, you know, screenshots can be quite, I think technically that would be very difficult, but they're also, you know, they could be quite useful as well in some circumstances if you need to do that. So political fandom then. Tell us a bit about fandom. What is fandom? It seems to be to me like a new word that's sort of like come about in recent times.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that since I've been working on this, which is, you know, sort of probably 4 or 5 years, and then it's the writing starting to come out about it maybe 3 years ago, both political fandom and fandom itself have both become much bigger things. So it's been quite difficult to persuade people that fandom isn't new, it's just being written about more. So a fandom is more purposeful than just being a fan base. Anyone can be the fan base. If you like something, you're in the fan base. A fandom is a community that and an identity that's created around something that people like, usually some sort of cultural property, whether it's a football team or it's an actor or it's it's a politician or a member of a boy band or whatever. You know, you might talk to other people about the thing, you might make things about it, you might have it in your profile on social media, you might watch loads of videos on YouTube about it, you might talk to your friends about it, you might go to events about it. And some people had written little bits about politics and fandom before, but they either didn't really understand fandom, which is quite common from the politics people, they didn't really understand that kind of joy that people get from it, but also the identity and community aspect, that it's very important that it's part of you and that you can meet other people and you can really get something from it beyond just enjoying it as a cultural property. Or they didn't understand the politics side of it, or how people get so into a campaign or a politician. And I think the Brexit debate has actually helped focus that in some people's minds. Obviously, I've written quite a lot about it, but the way people identify so strongly with being a Remainer or a Leaver that it's become more important than almost any other part of their identity. You look at their profiles on social media and there's various different emojis and signifiers they'll have in there, as well as hashtags. They're making and sharing content. They're part of communities online. They're very, very defensive if somebody attacks their thing. They're always promoting their thing. They become fans of individuals and campaigns within that. So, you know, there's EU Supergirl, Madeleine McKay, is raised thousands and thousands of pounds from what people have called, you know, thirsty dads, because she's an attractive young woman, etc., etc. But to go around Europe promoting the EU and make songs and do sketches and stuff like that, people have bought t-shirts with spiders on because of Baroness Hale. Like, they've got necklaces from Tati Divine that say European on, or they've got ones that are to do with feminism and resisting, like that stuff that people would always associate with perhaps being into Marvel comics or a football team or a band has crossed over into politics. And it's always been there in politics. People have always turned up and screamed at politicians or tried to get them their autograph and things like that. But I think because everything's so heightened now and you can get closer to them. I mean, people like Jess Phillips, who's in the Labour leadership race, she's just a backbencher. She's only been an MP since 2015. She's never held any significant role in politics, other than being an MP. But she's entirely created her whole media profile off being noisy on social media and getting a fandom around her, and to the point where, you know, she quote tweeted, which is a naughty thing to do if you're somebody with the number of followers she has, somebody who didn't have many followers calling her a gobby cow, which obviously is abusive, but I mean, she then obviously created a pile on that person and suggested that she should make a t-shirt
I saw that
saying gobby cow, and getting it printed, and then, you know, her fans were inundating with it, and loads of people were saying, yes, I'd buy it. I mean, that's kind of ludicrous. Can you imagine, you know, Tony Blair, who did have a lot of fans, getting a t-shirt printed up saying tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime?
No. Yeah.
I need that on a tote bag. It's almost like that the carts come before the horse. There was a moment in the election campaign where I sort of thought, oh, Labour's going to lose some of these seats that look like they always looked like they were safe. You know, people have been talking about the red wall of Labour seats that couldn't be breached in the North East and in Yorkshire. And Laura Pidcock, who had been tipped as a future leader, at least a future deputy leader, a lot of people in the on the left of the party had been hoping that she would run after Jeremy Corbyn, at least as deputy, if not the leader of the party. She did her launch for the election campaign in concert, which is part of her seat in Northwest Durham.
Yep.
And that is not an area that has loads and loads of young people screaming for politicians. It just isn't. So obviously a lot of the people are coming from other areas to this hall and filled it. And Unite the Union had printed up all these T-shirts saying Laura Pidcock with their own logo for Laura, and then these tote bags with a slogan on. And there are all these pictures of this on social media. And I just thought, that's putting the cart before the horse. Like, that is not London. That is not Manchester. That is not an area where that's organically happening.
Yeah.
This is actually probably going to rub people up the wrong way. You know, it's building the merch before the people are ready and having to give them away rather than sell it.
That's it. There's usually demand there and people asking for it before that happens. But you're right. That whole thing it might have existed to a certain degree in the past, but nowhere near to the sort of level that it is now. Yeah. And I guess social media has played quite a big part in that. I thought it was interesting with the Jess Phillips thing that, I mean, she is good, like you say, at building a base, and she uses social media well in the fact that, going back to the T-shirt thing, because I'm pretty sure that she was actually asking people for, it was either for like recommendations for T-shirt designers or even actually recommendations for designs. And so that's getting people involved, isn't it? And that sort of stuff does work really well on social media, because you feel, which links back to your fandom thing, you start to feel part of the actual community then. If you're playing a part in designing that T-shirt, then, well, wow, you're kind of like a bigger part of something than perhaps just going to an event and clapping your hands.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I wrote a piece for The Eye that kind of followed the fandom thing up, that was about how political engagement is actually a good thing, because during the New Labour years, although Tony Blair did win, you know, three elections on the trot, it was with a vastly reduced majority every time. And even in the big landslide of 1997, there was a lot of tactical voting involved from the Lib Dems. He'd been talking to Paddy Ashdown and stuff like that. And the voter turnout was lower than it had been in the previous election in 1992. So fewer people voted for Tony Blair in that landslide than had voted for John Major in 92. And, you know, John Major wasn't exactly hugely popular himself, you know. And then in 2001, you know, the voting levels were ridiculously low turnout. Nobody was bothered. Nobody was that bothered in 2005. 2010, you know, the Conservatives couldn't get a majority. It was only in 2017 when the voter turnout went back up, because people felt like more was at stake. And that's partly to do with the bounce that you always get after a referendum. You know, we got that in Scotland after the Scottish referendum. But also just people care about politics. And it's partly because everything's a mess at the moment. I mean, I remember listening to Matt Chorley on the Red Box podcast talking about his stand-up show, This Is Not Normal, which is about politics, since he's been writing about it. And he said, well, you know, it's a bit, we can't function as a country if people are watching BBC Parliament every night rather than getting on with their life. So perhaps we don't need that level of intense engagement. We do need a government that functions and stuff like that. But I don't think we should want to go back to the days where nobody knew or cared who any of the politicians were. They thought that voting was a waste of time.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a positive thing.
You can't
change
anything. You know, lots of people, because of all of the engagement around the Brexit referendum, actually a lot of people have got involved in other campaigns in their local area that are nothing to do with party politics, that are just to do with stuff that they care about. Like, I'm working on something at the moment about protests, because last year there were a lot of people who went on protests for the first time in their lives, and it's actually been a lot safer to do that, I think, partly because of social media and being able to find stuff about it. But obviously you're going on a much bigger protest with a fully policed route, and it's kind of like nice and middle class and safe now. I went to one of the big pro-EU marches the day after a Brexit party rally. I'm being balanced in journalism terms. But I was able to bob in and out of different parts of the march as I fancied, escape out of a bit when I wanted to, which I wasn't in any danger of being kettled or police. I wasn't going to be battered around the head like Alfie Meadows was in the 2010 protest. You know, it's become one of those things that lots of people can do. I went down to see the pink boat for Extinction Rebellion in Leeds. There were people of all ages, their whole families there, where the grandma had come down to the toddler. You know, they're taking the day off school for the 10-year-old. Like everyone was there. And it's just changed the character of protests now, that kind of engagement, and people finding each other via special Facebook groups and WhatsApp and what have you.
Yeah. I think that's a good note to pretty much finish on, because we have actually overrun
out of time.
Out of time. But it's been absolutely fascinating chatting to you, Penny. And just one final question before I go. You mentioned Coke earlier, and I do understand that you're a bit of a fan of Coke Zero. Yeah. And a question that I ask all my guests: if you were to go for a Coke Zero with any living person, who would that be and why?
If I was going to go for Coke Zero with any living person, I think I'd go with Madonna, because
Madonna before.
I know, she's such a fascinating chameleon, and I'd like to see if I was able to get underneath all of the layers that she projects.
Find the real Madonna.
Couldn't, but I'd like to try.
Great answer. Thank you very much for that, and thank you again for being on the show. Best of luck for 2020.
Thank you for listening to the Social Media Show, sponsored by NILC. If you'd like to know more about how social media can help your business, organisation or charity, please visit my website at pollingersocial.co.uk, or you can find me on social media at pollingersocial.